This tape is the property of the Winter Gren Foundation and cannot be rebroadcast, used, quoted, or transcribed without the express permission of the Foundation. This is the New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section Lecture Series for April 29th, 2013, with Anna Ramos-Zayas of Baruch College, discussing cartography of racial democracy, race, affect, and the production of abject subjects among Brazilians and Puerto Ricans in Newark.
Hi, welcome everybody. Welcome to the New York Academy of Sciences at Winter Gren Talk Series. This is our final talk for the academic year, and we're very pleased that you all have come, and we're pleased that our speaker and her discussant have also come to join us, and I'll be introducing them in a few seconds. But before I do, I just want to make a few announcements about the New York Academy of Sciences and what's going on with the anthropology section. First of all, this is the last meeting where Rudy Gaudio and I will be co-chairs. We are stepping down after today, and I would just like to introduce our new co-chairs, who are Brian Boyd and Janice Sotikoff, who are here, and we're very thrilled that they're going to be taking over. We have a really exciting program for next year that's already in the works that they're going to be in charge of and facilitating, including Marshall Solins is coming on September 30th. So that's our first talk of the year. So that's kind of an exciting thing to happen. I don't think he's been to New York in a while. So, you know, the four of us kind of worked together to get that on the program, and now Rudy and I can kind of slink away. So that's, but I wanted to also take a moment to thank Rudy for being my co-chair with me. It's been a pleasure to work with you for the last 2 years. I think we accomplished a great deal in the last 2 years, we and the committee, in bringing interesting talks to the Winter Gren Foundation, which is housing them, and also to kind of create some interesting dialogue in New York City across departments. And that's kind of the goal of our program. And it's been a pleasure to work with you, and it's been a pleasure to work with the whole committee. And I'm really thrilled and grateful for the experience that I've had, and really, really grateful to be passing it on to the new co-chairs. So thank everybody on the committee. I'd also like to thank Winter Gren, Leslie Aiello, who's the president of Winter Gren, sends her regrets. She was expected to be here today, but then I think had to go off to California for some unexpected trip. I don't know, Richard, if you have a... Oh, okay. So, but we have some Women of Winter Gren representation, and, you know, we are very grateful to Winter Gren for hosting us. It's been a really productive collaboration with the Winter Gren Foundation, and we're looking forward to many years in the future of working together with them to bring this kind of event to fruition. Now, without further ado, I want to introduce tonight's speaker. She is Anna Ramos-Zayas. We're very excited to have her here. This is something we've been planning in our minds for several years, and we finally found the spot on the program for you. She is professor and Valentin Lizana y Paraguay, endowed chair in the Department of Black and Hispanic Studies at Baruch College. Her research and writing focus on race, inequality, and the anthropology of affect and emotion on youth cultures, U.S. Latino communities, and U.S. Latino communities in Puerto Rico and Brazil. She has 3 books and many, many articles. I couldn't possibly mention everything that she has done. She's an amazing scholar. We're really excited to have her in the CUNY system and in this position. But her most recent book, which is fantastic, and I took a look at it before tonight, and I think it's just brilliant and interesting, is called Street Therapists, Race, Affect, and Neoliberal Personhood in Latino Networks. It's University of Chicago Press. It just came out in January 2012. And this is a really interesting book because it's really bringing affect theory together with race theory and on studies of neoliberalism. It's completely original. It's the first book that's been doing this, bringing together affect and neoliberalism and race. And so it's extremely important, and we're really excited to have her here to talk to us tonight. Her talk tonight which I wrote down, here it is, is called Cartography of Racial Democracy, Race, Affect, and the Production of Abject Subjects Among Brazilian and Puerto Rican, amongst Brazilians and Puerto Ricans in Newark. I'm very pleased to have you here. Thank you so much for coming, and let's welcome our speaker for tonight.
Attendance. We like to know who's here because we get repeat visitors and then we get new people. We like to know about the mix. So I'm going to pass these around. If you could sign one of these sheets, that'd be great. And I want to say that it was equally my pleasure to meet you, Jeff. So if you could sign these, great. And look forward to your talk. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, thank you for that great introduction and for inviting me. This is the first time that I'm here, and I'm sure it's not going to be the last. I'm going to be very much attentive to what else is coming because it sounds like there is a great program that has been going on. This is a very high podium for somebody who's short, but I will work with it. That's okay. That's fine. So the paper that I'm going to be presenting today is drawn from the book Street Therapists. And towards the end, because usually when I present something that has already been published and out, it feels kind of like has a finality that I just don't want it to have. I want to leave a little bit of openness for input from people. And so towards the very end, I just want to introduce a little bit of what I'm working on now and what I'm just barely starting kind of go into, and maybe that will open it up a little bit and won't feel as final and conclusive or something. So I'm going to start by narrating, just introducing an anecdote or a vignette from my work in two neighborhoods in Newark, and we'll start kind of disentangling what I mean by cartography of racial democracy, which, as Jeff explained, really focuses on the intersection of affect, race, and neoliberalism. On a late afternoon in March of 2008, in one of the several beauty salons in Newark's Ironbound, an African-American woman wearing a dark green tailor suit and heels complained that a Brazilian worker had missed a hair in her eyebrow waxing job. As the African-American woman inspected her eyebrow in the mirror, the Ecuadorian manicurist called out to the Brazilian worker, "Ursula, Ursula, she wants you to fix her eyebrows." Ursula quickly fixed the eyebrow situation, and the client was promptly on her way, when another Brazilian manicurist sitting nearby commented, "I don't know how she can even see that hair. She's so dark, you can barely distinguish her eyebrows at all." This provoked laughter throughout the small hair salon. Another Brazilian worker doing my nails remarked in a lower voice in Portuguese, "They like to complain about everything. And for what? Why be in that state of mind?" The Ecuadorian worker at the next table, as if to explain or clarify what everyone seemed to be agreeing on, and perhaps also to test my own solidarity with the statements that were being circulated, remarked in Spanish, "Es que son muy peleonas las morenas, ¿verdad? Se quejan mucho ellas." Black women like to fight, right? They complain a lot. A bit unsure about how to respond or even if a response was expected from me, I replied with a question. "Ah, ¿usted cree? ¿Se queja mucho entonces? Oh, do you think so? They complain a lot?" "¿Qué es usted? ¿De dónde es?" "What are you? Where are you from?" she replied with a very basic question that in Newark can mean nothing or be quite loaded depending on the context, characters involved, and circumstances. "Soy puertorriqueña. I'm Puerto Rican." "Ah," was her response. From my experience doing fieldwork in Newark for over 6 years at that time, I could tell that her "ah" was what Bakhtin would consider an ideologically situated utterance that that contained ideas about Puerto Ricans and how I fit or not into those ideas. In a seamless back-and-forth bantering in Portuguese and Spanish, the predominantly Brazilian and Ecuadorian staff in the small beauty salon shared stories about their experiences with black clients. One of the young Brazilian hairstylists talked about another African-American client who had come to the beauty salon earlier that week to color her hair. "She wanted to color it blonde," the Brazilian hairstylist laughed, "and she was even darker than me." Then there was collective laughter at the presumed absurdity, or at the very least, bad taste of such a request. Did you color it for her? Another Brazilian worker who was sweeping the floor asked. Of course, as long as she pays, not only do I do it, I tell her that she looks pretty too, with a smile on my face. She responded, showing pride in her own business savvy, and even while aware of how it might border on deceit. And everybody laughed. More seriously and reflective, Ursula, who had done the wax job, commented, I agree, because, you know, you can see them, meaning black women, coming in with that face, she was mimicking this angry look, and you think, oof. But sometimes they have a better attitude when they leave here. Life is too short. Why be like that? End of quote. Many other salon workers agreed that one of the most important aspects of their job description was to become a street therapist of sort. Individuals who masterfully analyzed interpersonal interactions offered a sense of well-being and appeased emotional intensities to create an adequate affective landscape in a volatile urban setting. In this presentation, I identify the production of a U.S.-based cartography of racial democracy, an ideological and pragmatic navigational tool characterized not only by the use of humor, bantering, and nonverbal cues, but also by a particular sensitivity to evaluations of adequate affect, emotional competency, and life skills across perceived racial difference. The possibility of constructing race through language is carefully monitored, as can be seen by the constant inquisitiveness and attentiveness to other people's reaction to one's comments about color or race in the beauty salon episode. A sign of discomfort, such as a shift in one's posture, a glance, or a change in tone, would have ended the conversation very quickly, particularly if it came from a client. Residents of the Ironbound often felt that it was their role to transform Newark's aggressive image, associated with the 1967 riots and African Americans more generally, to a playful type of civility centered on good manners. In fact, this would be central to the commercial viability of their neighborhood. Certain tenets of Latin American racial democracy ideology provided the discursive tools to sustain the politics of conviviality. By focusing on the experiences of Brazilians and Puerto Ricans in Newark, I also witnessed the impact of U.S. racial projects on transnational individuals' affective worlds. Their perspective on the emotional subjectivities of the racialized others they encounter, and the ways in which Latin American migrants learn race in the U.S. in a deeply visceral and affective way. In the rest of this presentation, I draw from nearly a decade of fieldwork among Brazilian immigrants and U.S.-born Puerto Ricans in Newark, which resulted in the ethnography, which is the title of which is Street Therapist, Race, Affect, and Neoliberal Personhood in Latino Newark. And in particular, I focus on the quotidian emotional epistemologies that inform the unfamiliar racial situations that Latin American migrants and U.S.-born Latinos encounter and imagine, and which serve as a cartography to navigate an otherwise illegible social landscape. I begin with a brief background on the Ironbound specifically, and it's for those of you who are not too familiar with Newark and the distinctions, and also its residents, as they are imagined in New Jersey's media and popular culture at the time of my fieldwork. And I then situate the Beauty Salon episode in the context of broader Brazilian immigration perspectives or immigrant perspectives on U.S. blackness. In particular, I consider how Brazilians in Newark saw African Americans in gendered ways that highlighted their class identities, but which also presumed character defects, their inclinations to appropriating certain aspects of Brazilian culture, and their general inability to abide by the racial democracy ideologies that blacks in Brazil presumably embraced. Finally, I examined the that followed when I answered that I was Puerto Rican by showing how Puerto Ricans become constitutive outsiders, the abject U.S. subjects that often become proxy to blackness for the Latin American migrants with whom they come into contact. And then I conclude by introducing a little bit of what the next project will be, as I mentioned before. So the Ironbound is not like the rest of Newark, was probably the most circulated comment or answer by most of the people that I interviewed whenever I would ask them to describe this eastward neighborhood. The Ironbound was viewed as a productive Portuguese ethnic enclave that generated great revenue to the city, to a city that was otherwise decrepit, violent, and aggressive. In the early 1900s, Portuguese from Lisbon and Spanish primarily from the province of Galicia followed other European ethnics who had settled down neck, as the area was called. By the 1970s, the Italians and Cuban shops that had lined Ferry Street, the main commercial artery of the area, gave way to a burst of Portuguese investments. The incoming Portuguese immigrants acquired cheap land deemed undesirable after the 1967 riots, and since then have been credited for using their capacity, handiwork, and commercial skills to rebuild the Ironbound. In Newark, the Iberian ethnics were viewed as technicians of space, to use Foucault's term, credited with displaying loyalty to Newark by not following on the suburban flight of the Italian and Jewish populations that preceded them. The Portuguese had, in the words of an interlocutor, saved the Ironbound neighborhood brick by brick. The Ironbound relied on a commercialization of the census to distinguish itself from the rest of Newark. Description of the area invariably focused on the smells and taste of Iberian cuisine, the sounds of foreign languages in the streets, the sight of colorful Mediterranean tiles on local homes, and the multiple ethnic festivals that drew people from wealthier parts of New Jersey and even from other states in the summertime. In the Ironbound, the U.S. service sector that dominated other areas of Newark was associated with a lowbrow fast food industry typical of Newark's inner city. Allowing such businesses would culturally devalue the Ironbound and diminish the neighborhood's relative cachet and touristic appeal. Ironbound residents, in fact, and merchants alike, opposed, and sometimes quite effectively, the opening of fast food franchises in the area. So there was a big struggle against opening a Dunkin' Donuts, and they're very vigilant of these other kind of franchise fast foods that are considered very undesirable. In the late 1980s, the predominant Portuguese neighborhood began to receive more South American migrants, especially Brazilians, who had followed a pattern of settlement in Portuguese areas throughout the northeastern U.S. It was also in the 1980s that the Ironbound began to be showcased as a touristic stronghold of Newark. Since the 1990s, the neoliberal practices behind the so-called Newark Renaissance have centered on drawing corporate interest to Newark, including making the city safe for latte, a term circulated when the first Starbucks was about to open in the city. The Ironbound's appeal was premised on a universal sentimentality that, in addition to the strong sensorial dimensions described earlier, also included foregrounding individual and familial life histories. Life histories of hardships, sacrifice, pain, and overcoming complemented most media coverage of the neighborhood as a socially integrated area characterized by tightly knit, heteronormative families with good values. A reinvigorated discourse of individual responsibility and family morality, critical to Newark's neoliberal aspirations, sorted out into those who were productive citizens of the Ironbound and those who were underclassed residents of other areas of the city. The Ironbound became representative of the former, just as North Broadway, which is the other side, main side of my research, became emblematic of an underclassed Puerto Rican-ness. Certain aspects of the beauty salon episode suggest that interactions between Latin American migrants, particularly Brazilian in the case of the Ironbound, and African Americans produce potentially volatile moments of great individual anxiety, miscommunication, and personal negation that, if mismanaged, would be potentially disruptive to the Newark Renaissance image. Assumptions about affect and its adequate expression guided Brazilian migrants and some U.S.-born Puerto Ricans to develop nuanced interpretations of how one should feel when the goal was to create a productive persona with a neoliberally friendly disposition that would be in alignment with Newark's neoliberal goals. Informed by transnational racial ideologies of racial democracy, my interlocutors developed complex social practices around performances of blackness, understandings of socioeconomic hierarchies, and expectations of belonging on multiple scales, like the neighborhood, the nation, and the market. The centrality of the figure of African Americans, particularly African American women, was indicative of some central elements in the formation of our cartography of racial democracy in Newark. First, there was a frequent and remarkably consistent characterization of African Americans, like the case of the beauty salon client, as prone to complaining or never being satisfied. In fact, conversations that could have been about deconstructing instances of common oppression or subordination became really compromised by a rendition of race as insidiously situated in a defective psyche or defective emotive world of U.S. blacks. In a neighborhood characterized by a highly visible sector of ethnic restaurants, specialty stores, and body services like beauty salons, waxing, and massage services, the relationship between Latin American, particularly Brazilians, and African American was often one of worker-client, with the African American usually being more securely middle class and the Brazilian more working class. Whiteness, in these instances, acted as an invisible constitutive element to the production of anti-black attitudes among Brazilians and generally impeded the production of a Latino identity between Latin American migrants and U.S.-born Latinos. The African American client at the beauty salon was read in terms of race, but also in terms of her class identity and performance, most evident in having the persons in power to seek beauty salon services and her professional dress code or dress style. For Brazilians and other South Americans, some interactions with African Americans sustained and were congruous with Latin American social conventions and class locations, while others were distinctly reflective of a life trajectory that might involve downward mobility, undermine social status, or other forms of class-based changes that might have resulted from migration. In the Ironbound, middle-class African Americans oftentimes interacted with Portuguese, Brazilian, and other South American migrants by wearing their class to distance themselves from the predictable stereotypical images that some residents had of blacks. Ironbound merchants, including beauty salon personnel, waitstaff, and store clerks, played an important role in maintaining racial civility, despite the fact that even small events in Newark could trigger polarized racial discord. Brazilian women highlighted their ability to find more joy in life, that was a very common term, and to have a more positive relationship with their own femininity than other non-Brazilian women they encountered in Newark. Malleability, the ability to adapt without complaining, while also not being passive, became a salient aspect of these life skills. Unquote. Even the ones that have a lot of money, meaning African-Americans that have a lot of money, are still angry. They don't know how to live, end of quote, remarked a young Brazilian woman in reference to the African-American client that came into the clothing store where she worked. African-American women were viewed as not being in touch with their femininity as Brazilian women were. Brazilians, especially workers in the Ironbound, felt that an important contribution they made to life in the U.S. and U.S. society in general was their ability to show people how to live well, joyfully, and avoid getting depressed. And actually, this is obviously their own perception, not a reflection of the reality. There was actually quite a significant number of eating disorders, people openly stating that they had eating disorders and other issues associated with depression. So it's a little bit of the contradiction between what you're projecting versus what you witness. The idea of a black elite experiencing discrimination was unimaginable for many Brazilians who associated financial power with emotional contentment, or at least with something that would shield the individual from allowing racism to impact them at an intimate level. It is not necessarily that these Brazilian Ironbound residents believed that having money would make others less racist towards them, but that even when others were racist, one could choose not to care about it emotionally if one had the money. Cristina Andrade, an ESL teacher in the Ironbound, for instance, viewed the Portuguese as racist towards the Brazilians, but still situated this racist comportment in the realm of emotion. For instance, she highlighted how Portuguese women were jealous of Brazilian women. They feared that they would steal their husband, and this was a complete narrative that was dominant in the Ironbound, that it was like almost a continuation of a telenovela kind of narrative, very, very developed and really sophisticated and full of intrigue and everything. So, but this particular ESL teacher, you know, even though she herself, she describes herself as preta or black, she had a coveted job, owned a car, and had been successful in a short time. So she said something like, why would I care, this quote, why would I care if they are racist toward me, being the Portuguese? My well-being doesn't depend on them, so why would I care? So it was that idea of like, okay, if I have all these other things, so that would shield me from that other kind of racist attitudes. A focus on jealousy and complaining reflected a more general apprehension that Brazilians had over ascribing racial labels, at least in public, to others. This strategy was also an expression of emotional capital that sustained particular personal and commercial aspirations among service sector and bodywork employees and business owners in the Ironbound. And this is also something that Jennifer Lee found in the case in another study that she did in Brooklyn. Race provided both pretext and context in a powerful, somewhat reductive fashion for locating the meaning in an unkind remark taken the wrong way or a misstep, an abrupt impropriety. Anthropologist Kathleen Stewart refers to this form of ordinary affect as the constant possibility of misinterpretation, transgression, and betrayal animating the realm of everyday life. Rather than a sect of fixed beliefs, which also existed, race was negotiated through rhetorical identities, verbal bantering, and psychological labels, in this case of the cartography of racial democracy that I've noticed. Many of the Brazilians whom I met in Newark's Ironbound understood that there was a global image of Brazilian culture that was highly commodified and visceral and emotive. Expressions of cultural excess and awareness of the commodified aspects of a global Brazilian culture of samba, capoeira, football, but also of a way of being in the world was always highlighted. In the case of Brazilian life in Newark, this cultural excess oftentimes served as a strategic way of presenting oneself effectively as an individual who possessed great social and emotional skills and psychological savvy and who would make a good adaptable worker in compliance with local service sector demands. In the U.S., cultural excess was a complementary and dialectically social position that many Brazilians deployed to get closer to a locally constituted form of Americanness while still drawing on the potential advantages of being bearers of a globally exported and highly marketable way of being, like being open, welcoming, accepting, and all the other characteristics that they argued were associated and everybody recognized as being Brazilian. Brazilians understood and promoted their own placement in the Ironbound cultural market through a narrative that rather than being premised on traditional ethnic values, as was often the case with Iberian ethnics in the area, in fact gained its appeal from a claim to modernity, racialness, inclusivity, and an image of Brazil in cosmopolitan terms, distinct from other Latin American nations that were viewed as more backwards or rural, and the images were very different. Brazil, in fact, possessed a unique soft power, the power to export ideologies, practices, and ways of being. In Newark's Ironbound, a neighborhood in which Luso-Brazilian, Latinos, and African-American populations were not only shaped by their relationships with state institutions, but also judged by their contribution to capital accumulation, the ability to create commercially profitable cultures and package oneself accordingly became fertile grounds for resurrecting views of racial democracy, especially those that linked racial mixture to intimacy, harmony, attractiveness, and a higher emotive moral ground. While not always explicitly articulated in such terms, views of African-American appropriation of Brazilian culture appeared occasionally in conversations about commercial activities in the neighborhood. For instance, Maura noted, quote, "Black Americans like to take capoeira classes, samba, eat our food. They think we're pretty, and that's why the African-American women don't like us. I see them at the eating places around here. I went to a capoeira school once because a friend of mine was trying to get a job with them, and they looked at us like they were the real Brazilians and we didn't belong there. I asked her why she thought this was the case, and she responded, 'They think they're more Brazilians than we are. because they think that only if you're really dark, you can be Brazilian, you know? And I'm a little dark, but not very. But in Brazil, you can also have blonde hair, blue eyes, too. I never went there again. End of quote. The presumable claim to a transatlantic bond around blackness was viewed as a misrecognition or false assumption that certain emotions were shared when they, in fact, weren't. Paula Pereira, who was originally from Belo Horizonte, remarked on a common racial harmony mythology attributed to Brazil that echoed the perspective of other Brazilians with whom I spoke in Newark. Paula stated, quote, "There is racism in Brazil, definitely. And there's racism here, but the difference is that there we still get along. Everyone tries to get along, even if you know there's racism. And after you get along with the person for a while, you don't even notice the color anymore. It doesn't even cross your mind. Here you always notice the color. You grab your purse, get scared when you see a black person. I'm not proud of that, but that's how it is. And I've talked to other friends of mine about that, and they also feel the same way." End of quote. Among many Brazilians, there was an ability not so much to deny, but rather to avoid racial identity almost altogether. The tremendous depth of the racial democracy ideology did not necessarily suggest that racial democracy was gullibly accepted, but that there was a preference for avoiding discourses of race. And this is something that also was found among some populations in a favela in Rio de Janeiro that Robin Sherry focused on her work. From a sociolinguistic perspective, Jennifer Simpson argues that many Latin Americans of color, in an attempt to undermine racism, engage in white talk, that is the active attempt to ignore, forget, or deny racism through selective hearing, creative interpreting, and complicitous forgetting. But what I'm describing here goes beyond that. It is almost an attempt to gain social competence by dismissing the intimate power of race and what race can do to a person. Dominant readings of African Americans rendered racism as something that could be managed by the individual as long as he or she had the adequate emotional tools not to allow discrimination to penetrate his or her psyche. Despite a cursory acknowledgement to slavery and segregation under Jim Crow, the focus on these interpretations tended to be on current present-day effects in psychological terms of such history. Such landscape was premised on a view that deep down all individuals feel and experience an environment in emotional and sensorial terms that were universal, while also establishing criteria by which to judge the emotional adequacy of those individuals who did not meet neoliberal-friendly standards of civility. A translocal emotive and neoliberal ideology constituted around the cartography of racial democracy situated discussions of racism in the realm of affect and intimate knowledge. References to racial diversity within families, interracial romantic relations, and emotive or comedic interactions, instead of unthinkable political manifestos or denunciations of discrimination, for instance, offered the leading everyday evidence that racism could be somehow ignored. It is important to know that the cartography of racial democracy that I witnessed in Newark, which oftentimes consider denunciations of racist practices as pointless or even unacceptable in the public realm, could not be simplistically explained away as a lack of racial consciousness or a false consciousness among Latin American migrants. Rather, it suggests that these populations generally did not look to the state to eradicate racism or create racial equality in the way that African American and many U.S.-born Latinos, particularly those who lived through the civil rights movements, did. Oftentimes, Brazilians simply did not see how or why would the U.S. nation state, or any state for that matter, be invested in eradicating discrimination. From this pragmatic rather than ideological perspective, it made no sense to denounce racism. Race was rarely invisible, but its hyperconsciousness oftentimes required that intergroup tensions be understood in the terrain of affect, emotions, and aesthetics, not political economy or neighborhood politics. I want to highlight the positions that Puerto Ricans played in all this. I, as I said in the beginning, most of my work concentrated in two specific neighborhoods of Newark, the two neighborhoods that had the largest Latino communities, one of them being the Ironbound and the other one being North Broadway, which was a predominantly Puerto Rican neighborhood. The largest Latino group in Newark consisted of Puerto Ricans, most of whom were second or even third generation U.S. born. Puerto Ricans violated the racial sensibility of many Latin American migrants, particularly Brazilians, by communicating race through the use of ethno-racial labels and by being critical of the good intentions and Americanness of whites. Whereas for Brazilians, being anti-racist oftentimes meant viewing Brazilianness as a nationality produced from racial mixing, the idea of mestizaje, U.S.-born Puerto Ricans generally understood it in light of civil rights politics and contemporary, affinities with some African Americans and other Latinos. And I don't want to overstate the connection because there was a lot of tension between Puerto Ricans and African Americans as well. But the understanding of those tensions were very, very explained very differently than they were with the Brazilians. Puerto Ricans embodied a complicated concept of privilege in relation to other Latin American immigrant groups. When such privilege was assumed to come from U.S. citizenship, English language skills, and place of birth, since most Puerto Ricans in Newark were second and third generation U.S. born. They were considered to be versed in an urban vernacular, oftentimes connected to African Americans in media and hip-hop culture, and were associated with culture of poverty discourses, including welfare abuse, laziness, moral decay, etc. As I discussed elsewhere, Puerto Ricans had to engage in a politics of worthiness to actively and consistently articulate the ways in which they were deserving of U.S. citizens and citizenship, despite the delinquent citizenship attributed to them. And they did this by highlighting military participation and explaining that they had participated in pretty much most wars and constituted a high percentage of the Latinos in the military, etc. In the northeastern U.S., Brazilians have frequently settled in areas of significant Puerto Rican presence, leading to the view that Puerto Ricans were the nemesis or cautionary tale of what Brazilian immigrants should avoid. For instance, journalist John Stefanini highlights an entrepreneurial spirit that Brazilian immigrants possessed, but which longtime Puerto Rican residents lacked in his description of Framingham, Massachusetts. And this is a quote from his piece. A sector of the Brazilian population that is coming here consists of people with high qualifications that I should characterize as entrepreneurial. The Puerto Rican community lives here, for instance, for two or three generations and still has not set up businesses, whether these are family businesses or companies. Already the Brazilian population that has been here for only 10 years, they're here, they have opened companies, family businesses, they are doing things. I'd say they are more educated and entrepreneurial people, opening businesses and taking risks and working really hard. The heightened stigmatization of Puerto Ricans in the U.S. has also been a theme in Brazilian fiction. For instance, in Roberto Ataide, Brasileiros in Manhattan, the author notes, quote, among those who come to the Disco Cathedral in New York are the Raleigh, the scum, composed of Puerto Ricanos, Negros, y Desabrigados, Puerto Ricans, Blacks, and the Destitute, end of quote, who are described as, quote, starving to death and impolite. In Newark, Puerto Ricans were the default Latino nationality category in the eyes of Blacks or whites, who could hardly view a difference, and Brazilians and other Latin American migrants were very aware of this. Engaging in the process of learning race render Brazilians and Puerto Ricans street therapists, a term I used earlier and which I developed in the ethnography to identify the calculated dedication to observing and correcting defective, i.e. non-marketable, forms of blackness, developing appropriate feeling rules, to use Hochschild's words, and hesitantly embracing a neoliberal personhood. Puerto Ricans, as U.S.-born minorities, and also a group that was highly expressive of their national ancestry, became both an example of how not to become American because of their proximity to blacks, and an invaluable source of knowledge in the process of learning race among Latin American groups, including Brazilians. Puerto Ricans were masters in distinguishing what they themselves consider racismo de verdad, true racism, the one that merited a response and a challenge, versus racismo de relajo, fake racism, the use of racial labels to assert solidarity through an emphasis on racial difference. A conversation with Amarilis Guzman, a young Puerto Rican resident of North Broadway, pointed to instances in which Puerto Ricans assumed aimed to soften what they viewed as racial overdeterminism with a form of communicative verbal and nonverbal play in another version of a cartography of racial democracy. After graduating from high school, one of the part-time jobs that Amarilis Guzman took was as a receptionist at the Prudential Building in Newark downtown. When I asked her about the people who she met through her job, Amarilis commented, quote, "The white people that come by our building, they don't know the difference between Latinos. If you're caramel skin, brown eyes, curly hair, you're automatically assumed to be Puerto Rican, no matter if you're Brazilian or Dominican or whatever," end of quote. Amarilis furthermore described her work environment by noting the emotional styles and humor among her coworkers. Quote, "I work with Brazilian, Dominicans, Haitians. In my job, we're always talking about people's backgrounds, bantering and joking around. We have to do that because we have nothing better to do at that stupid job." And that's, you know, and that's in itself a commentary on the neoliberal politics of work. My black friend would be like, "Hey, you, habichuela, come here." And I'd be like, "Stop playing nigger naps," end quote. We just look at each other and laugh. Because are you really that stuck on everything that happens that you can't laugh at things? And the other people who are not black or Puerto Rican look at us and they're like, "Oh my God, she just called her nigger." They think that there's going to be another riot, you know? End of quote. The distinction between forms of racial interpretation, between a racism that is presumably more real and tangible than another, also pointed to an alternative form of racial knowledge among Puerto Ricans, one that distinguished between an individual's emotional ease and stiffness in racial talk. The ability to joke about color without entirely subscribing to a U.S. racial etiquette ironically gave a false sense of greater racial tolerance. This urban emotional common sense highlighted the importance among racialized communities of knowing what not to know in public, what has been termed by other anthropologists as implicit social knowledge, Tossig calls it, noble communities, Raymond Williams' term, and cultural intimacy, as Hartsfeld has referred to it. The affective function of many verbal and nonverbal communication practices demonstrates how emotive meaning is constructed interactionally and interreferentially, as different affective indexes can also key contradictory meanings. The ability to be playful regarding race, of not taking racial or color comments too seriously, signaled a commercially and personally valuable ability to carve a space to experiment with racismo de relajo, which, by the way, I also noticed in my fieldwork in Puerto Rico in terms of the Puerto Rican-Dominican relationships on the island. The idea of, like, that's a joking form of bantering versus that's a real form of racism. By its very description, this form of racial play excluded most African-Americans and some whites in Newark, who were viewed to be too invested in being, quote-unquote, angry or being really racist. Nevertheless, in the context of intimate friendships or working under absurdly unstimulating circumstances, as the one described by Amarilis above, Puerto Ricans and blacks tacitly understood the racial bantering to be qualitatively and experientially different from structural forms of racism by people who actually had the power to be racist and whose racism actually had an impact in their lives. This was a form of racial learning that some Latin American migrants observed and analyzed, but were not always able to access experientially or viscerally. The linguistic pattern in Puerto Rican racial talk was shifting, highly dependent on context, and the form of knowledge this required was oftentimes described by Brazilians and other Latin American migrants as emotionally exhausting and overwhelming. They constituted a fundamental practice in the intersection of race and emotion, which required a navigational tool that I've been calling cartography of racial democracy. As in the Beauty Salon episode, identifying a location within a prism of racism often led to a changing etiquette governing speaking rules and verbal content in public discourse. What counted as racist was much more circumscribed among some groups, particularly recent immigrants, like Brazilians, and more extensive and nuanced among other U.S.-born Latino groups like Puerto Ricans. And approaching the conclusion, just wanted to mention also that the cartography of racial democracy required that racial difference be reconstituted as differences in emotional styles that were highlighted in affected terms in everyday urban interactions. The inscription of race in a language of emotion was not difficult to establish, since whites had already begun the process around the time of the 1967 racial rebellions, when the U.S. mainstream media, the nation's popular imaginary, and whites who had flown the city began to view Newark as synonymous with aggressive blacks and angry mobs. Newark has since been a city that feels aggressive, as some people put it. The absence of white bodies, the phantom of whiteness, provided a foundation for the ways in which a racial affect was perceived and experienced among Latinos and Latin Americans in contemporary Newark. In this context, the cartography of racial democracy serves as a navigational tool through which Latin American migrants and U.S.-born Latino populations identified certain emotional styles and affective dispositions as more effective for capital accumulation, premised on an everyday conviviality directed towards productivity, than others. Such a cartography highlighted differences between race in the U.S. and in Brazil, and in Latin America or U.S. Latino communities more broadly, in the realm of the intimate, and led to a deepened sense of racial relativism that, in fact, was compliant with neoliberal objectives in Newark. This work has explored effective articulations of race in a context in which whites are presumed absent. In fact, in some ways, whites are constitutive outsiders of Newark's racial landscape. They remain largely unexamined, and their racial neutrality and privilege protected from ethnographic scrutiny. This shortcoming and the productive possibilities offered by critical race theory and scholars in the field of critical white studies, too, to further explore the intersections of affect and race has served as impetus for my next long-term project. This project will examine the impact of three wealthy neighborhoods, Ipanema, Rio de Janeiro, El Condado, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and the Upper West Side in Manhattan, on how affluent parents emotionally and racially socialize their children. I am hoping that this future research will consider the following questions. Is circumscribing race and racial learning to the realm of the emotional or psychological necessarily disempowering? What do effective articulations of race look like in spaces of racial and class privilege? I believe that examining these questions is long overdue, and that critical empirical examinations of affect, race, and privilege to balance out our anthropological fascination with the marginal is likely to yield or reveal another side of how marginality is produced in the first place. So this is one seems like a completely different project, and in some ways is very similar, but the context is very different. So I just wanted to conclude there and leave you with that example of where this hopefully will be going in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anna. That was a really brilliant and interesting talk, and I'm sure it's going to generate lots of questions. But before we entertain questions from the audience, we have a discussant. He is Edgar Rivera Colon. He is a medical anthropologist who works on HIV prevention education for Black and Latino youth. He also teaches at Columbia University, and he is also an activist. He is the founder and current director of Praxis Kairos. Is that a community research and mobilization consultant? So, welcome, Edgar. Please give your comments, and then I'll facilitate some questions from the audience after Edgar is finished.
Okay, so the podium's fine in terms of my size. Let's get a rounded survey. Right. So Anna's book has been for me a sort of gift in terms of thinking through my own ethnographic materials. And so this evening I'm just going to talk a little bit. How much time do I have, Jeff, actually? Okay, so very briefly I'm going to talk. I mean, you have to make sure it is very briefly. About a couple of things. And I want to talk about what they call in Latin America la coyuntura de recepción, the conjuncture of receiving the text. And I think that it's instructive to me that Anna's book comes out at the same time that Karen and Barbara Field's new book, Racecraft, The Soul of Inequality in American Life, have come out. And the Field sisters are trying to think through what's the difference between race, racism, and racecraft. And they're sort of doing a parallel between racecraft and witchcraft, actually, and how it functions. Do you guys remember that one? You know, the Azande? So I'm going to come back to that point, but one of the sort of interesting moments in a conversation that the Field sisters had with Adolph Reed in the Brooklyn Museum was that the reality of race in the sense of an ability to have material force, even as it is in one sense an ideological delusion, right? And she actually feels, Barbara brought up an example of Martin Luther thinking that the devil, I guess in Wittenberg Castle, was mooning him, and he was saying the devil's ass. And the only way to deal with it was to fart on the devil, right? So he actually believed that, right? He saw it as a reality. And I think there's an interesting conjuncture between the Fields book and also John Jackson's book, Real Black Adventures in Racial Sincerity. And I just want to think about maybe a way to sort of connect those discourses. So the one thing I was thinking about last night was a moment right after the presidential election 2008, when President Obama becomes the president. He starts talking to the press about buying a dog for his daughters, and he says, well, we'll have to get a hypoallergenic dog because one of the daughters is actually allergic, but it doesn't matter what kind of breed, you know, it could be like me, I'm a mutt, I'm an American, right? And again, those kind of moments that we've been having a lot of in this country around race and mixing and what is it to live in a country that has these emergent discourses that talk about post-raciality, right? And this is not a comfortable book to read if you come out of a sort of traditional liberal, progressive, anti-racist tradition, because it's doing something that I was trained not to do as an anthropologist, which is to engage the emotions and to engage race. It's sort of a hot material. And it's to me, I don't think it's a coincidence that John Jackson and Ana Yolanda Ramos Zayas have been the people to reintroduce these topics, right? Whereas our friends in the humanities, our beloved colleagues, separated brethren in the humanities, have been talking about affect and affect theory, but haven't really done the job around race. And it's interesting what ethnography can produce when you start thinking about it. And tonight I'll invoke the Dorothy Hodgson rules, who is my research methods professor at Rutgers. And Dorothy would always talk about going back to your ethnographic material. So I went back to my ethnographic material because I've been thinking about the book. And I basically do research in the house ballroom community. And just to give you a small definition of it, it's a working class, black and Latino, in New York City, LGBT kinship system and dance performance circuit. It began in the late 60s, Paris is burning. Okay, so blah, 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 blah. And so the... What was interesting to me as I did my field research was this constant term that my informants used called bringing it like a white woman, right? And it actually meant, and it's interesting, I was like, wow, this is really misogynist, isn't it? And I started thinking, and I asked them about it, and they were like, well, what we mean by that is doing it right, really being able to get the power you need and achieving something. And you have to think about, you know, black and Latino LGBT people who grew up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s, and who were these women who did have power in the hospitals that they worked in the public schools that they went to, in the different institutions they would interact outside of their communities. It was these white women, right? And so there's that other side of the ethnographic piece that I started thinking about. Oh, so bringing it like a white woman is like a strategy. It's a form of racial learning, which is, I think, what this book is about. How do people learn about race in the U.S. or consolidate that form of understanding in the case of Puerto Ricans, U.S.-born Latinos, but in the case of Brazilians, right? And the Ironbound, I'm from Hudson County, as you can tell, and one of the things you ask about Hudson County is, where are the good neighborhoods? where are the non-sketchy neighborhoods, right? And Ironbound has always been this place where you go to have seafood, right, whereas you don't want to go to Newark, right? So it's interesting that you're doing this work. And I don't think, again, I think there's a conversation for you, the Field Sisters, and Jonathan Jackson. Why don't we throw it out, Adolph Reed in there as well, to have around these issues and to try to open up this space around race, affect, and political economy. So street therapist. And the minute, you know, I was a graduate student when you were doing this research, right? And not to out you or anything. But and I kept on hearing these stories, right? And you could, like Annie Yolanda was saying, I really don't want to do this emotion stuff and all this other stuff. And as I heard the stories, it was clearer to me that she was going to go with this question of race and affect, and that there was this aspect of, when do you cross that theoretical Rubicon? When do you go directly into the emotions? And what Anna has done in this book is really develop an emotion-based theory of practice, right? And infused it with this race piece. And I think that's an important contribution. And I actually don't think yet we're gonna take a while to work out the implications of your work. And certainly as a LGBT scholar, a queer man, the notion of street therapist I immediately liked, precisely because it violated the public-private realm. And therapy, or the therapeutic cultures that were sort of socialized in the United States, certainly is predicated upon this notion of the privacy of therapy. In New York, everyone says, oh, who's your therapist, right? And I think street therapist is sort of talking about what happens to people when their power and the critique of sort of anti-racist movements has been remanded to the emotional. I don't think what Annie Yolanda is doing is celebrating this. I think she's sort of documenting it. And I think the other, if you will, the other side of the contradiction or the antinomy, depending on how you look at it, is really whiteness. You know, what is it? And I think, you know, visually, I would like to put in this book in dialogue with The Sopranos. Because it's sort of a documentary or ethnographic attempt to think about a type of masculinity that I grew up in. Right, sort of an Italian working class masculinity. When I grew up in downtown Jersey City, before it was interesting to real estate speculators, it was basically blacks, Puerto Ricans, some Cubans, they hadn't gone to Union City yet, and some Dominicans, and old Italians, Irish, Polish, well, what I guess sociologists would call the old white ethnics, right? And so there was this understanding that we need to sort of think about. And I think the whiteness piece, and I'm very glad, I'm very happy that you're deciding to do the Upper West Side and all these different, because I think that's the piece that's been missing in terms of this stuff. I don't want to go on forever, but I do want to think a little bit, just for a moment, about this question that the Field Sisters bring up, Barbara and Karen, in Racecraft. And I think what they're trying to get us to think about is, this is something that anthropologists know sort of immediately, you know it in your, you know, academic version of your mother's milk, is that race has no ontological reality, right? And racism, they argue, is really a system where you create double standards predicated upon ancestry. And that Racecraft is really this other piece, and they call it, just to quote, distinct from race and racism, Racecraft does not refer to groups or ideas about groups' traits, however odd both may appear in close-up. It refers to mental terrain and to pervasive belief. And they would add persuasive and pervasive, right? And like physical terrain, Racecraft exists objectively. That's an interesting thing for historians and sociologists to say. It has typographical features that Americans navigate regularly. And this is the cartography piece that aligns with your racial, sort of this notion of a navigational sort of index. And we cannot readily stop traversing it. Unlike physical terrain, Racecraft originates not in nature, but in human action and imagination, and it consists in no other way. This is the Fields, page 18. So I guess what is provocative to me about this piece that you declaimed for us here is this is the other part of gentrification, right? How do you create a friendly city? How do you create an ethos in a city where people will feel safe, right? And where everyone will know how to play his or her role in that city. So I'm a confounding factor in Jersey City. I am involved in community activism, but I'm actually someone who's from there. I'm a native, and I meet progressive whites who, oh, you're from here. I said, yeah, I'm from here. And so there's a whole set of questions we should ask about gentrification. And I think that New York City is a prime place to do that kind of research, and it doesn't get really talked about. I mean, and there's whole sets of ways of marking whiteness, of being white, and I think this is the other piece. Like, for example, I mean, I think if you want a material culture index of whiteness in the New York City subways, yoga mats are a clear place, right? And the notion of health or Whole Foods. Go to Whole Foods. Someone needs to do an ethnography of Whole Foods, obviously, to me, right? So this is the other piece that I think what's important is not only the ethnographic data itself, but the kind of provocation it could sort of stimulate in people as they do their research. It's funny, isn't it, that race always seems to be this discourse about the body. It never gets out of that, huh? And those of us who come out of women and gender studies, LGBT stuff, of course, the anthropology of the body, we have a lot of work to do. And I'm just happy, Anna Yolanda, that you've sort of provoked us. And I'm going to sort of end with a question or two. What are the connections in your mind between this question of racial sincerity, as John Jackson talks about, and authenticity? That's the distinction he's making, which is he's cribbing Lionel Trilling. It's actually a piece that Lionel Trilling, of the many, in 1970, in one of his Harvard lectures. And in this racial affect language that comes out of your, what's that connection? So what's the connection between authenticity and sincerity? And I guess the question I want to ask, and I guess I want to ask a panel that question, if I could organize a panel, are there street therapists practicing racecraft? Right? What kind of terrain are they occupying? Right? And how does that connect with sort of the traditional, not traditional, but the anthropology of the emotions? The one that I learned, right, the Lutz review article, the work that Rosaldo did, that kind. How does that connect with that anterior tradition? How did you take it into account? And how do you provide sort of a rationale for studying the emotions? Since, you know, I don't like psychology, certainly. I'm not a psychologist. How do we as anthropologists sort of make that statement that we should be? This is a terrain that we should be making interventions in. And I think I'll leave it there because I know it's only 10 minutes. Thank you.